Meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the webinar on the proposed updates to the operating standards for specific reviews. You can see on the starting slide that there might be a triumvirate of us presenting today. I'm afraid you will have to do just with me for the time being. My name is Lars Hoffmann. I'll lead you through this presentation, and then my colleagues will assist during the Q&A session at the end. And the second webinar today / 0100 hours tomorrow will be led by Larisa Gernick. And with that, I'm going to start the presentation. You see agenda here on the right in the AC room. For those of you who have joined us in the AC room, it's also on the slide here. Just before I dive in, you can find all the information on today's webinar, including the presentation and the underlying document on the wiki page. There's a link there in the chat. With that, I'm going to delve right in. A quick introduction / background on the draft operating standards. Some of you may recall we posted a complete document for public comment late last year. It was a very extended public comment period, run for just about 100 days, and closed on the 2nd of February. So this is kind of an update following from that. This is an overview, essentially, proposing updates to the draft that was published last year in several key areas, kind of taking into account community feedback from the public comment, as well as recent experiences from specific reviews that have been launched and conducted under new bylaws, obviously the CCT review, SSR2, and RDS as well, RDS2 review. It also takes into account some of the public feedback that received on the more recent public comment on the long-term options to adjust the timeline for specific reviews. The presentation here is not a presentation of a full, complete document, but rather of the kind of the key areas that that maybe are most important to the conduct, effective conduct of specific reviews, and that received most attention during the public comment period as well. Following this webinar, or these two webinars, there will be a public session at ICON63. The time and date here on Wednesday at 3:30 local time in room 133. We tried to get room 101, but that was not available, unfortunately. ICONORG will also post the complete revised draft operating standards, so full document with updates and also a redline version compared to what has been published for public comment prior to that in early December this year. But we'll look at that as well again during next steps at the end. With that, I'm going to launch in. The presentation is kind of structured to give an overview of kind of seven kind of areas where we've received either public comments and want to address that and kind of show what we want to update in the draft, or kind of new areas that have transpired from kind of lessons that we've learned throughout the conduct of ongoing specific reviews. The first one is the nomination of review team candidates. Quick heads up, through all of the presentation, RT is used in terms for an abbreviation of review team. The community feedback on the public comment was, first of all, that the non-binding analysis of skills and diversity that ICONORG is currently providing the SONACs for their selection process is welcome. Additionally, the SONAC should be allowed to nominate any candidate who applied, regardless of whether they sought nomination from that or from there or any other SOAC. So that was some of the feedback received. So what is proposed in the updated version is there should be continue to be a non-binding analysis of skills and diversity, as is already the practice, and kind of based on the skills that are required as per the call of volunteers. And each SOAC, following its own internal process, should nominate up to 7 candidates. For those of you familiar with this, it's obviously something that's mandated in the bylaws. And then each SOAC is encouraged to document its internal process, how they do the selection to exercise super transparency. You'll notice that it says encouraged and obviously not mandated. That's something I think the wider community would like to see. But if an SOAOC, for one reason or another, does not want to or cannot want to document that selection process, that's obviously acceptable. The SONAC shall take into consideration the candidate's skill set, diversity, and any potential conflict of interest and from the application. And they should kind of seek input on the desired skills from their peers, also on any conflict of interest, the wider community, and if appropriate, also ICANN organization, where they make their selection. Back to what we received, the feedback we received, the SONACs are not limited to selecting candidates that request their nomination from their SOAC, but they may nominate any of the candidates, which obviously means that from here on out, ICANN Org will share with the SONACs all the applicants with everybody rather than just sending specific ones to each of the SONACs. Alan just asking the chat, questions now at the end. Alan, if you have a question on this, go ahead. I'm just going to do the last bullet point, and then I'll turn to you. And then the SNOCs are encouraged to complete the selection within 10 weeks. Again, encouraged, not mandated, within 10 weeks of the closing of the call for volunteers. And if an SOAC requires more time, they should just inform their fellow SNOCs by what time they anticipate to have completed the selection process. And before I go to Alan, just very quickly on the time frame here, we've done that throughout the document to kind of encourage or suggest a timeline, but never to mandate it. This is to kind of give the review team a general idea of what kind of has happened in the past. These timelines are based on precedents, but always with the option if more time is required, then that is perfectly fine, just so that all the other SONACs should be updated or informed about that. Alan, you have a question, I assume?
I have two. Number one, on the issue of candidates are maybe nominated by an SOAC that they did not seek nomination from, that is a may, I presume, not obliged to. I'm just confirming, and I think it needs to be made clear because it's been a subject of some discussion within at least some ACs and SOs of whether we want to even consider someone who is not who did not seek our nomination, and recalling that the form typically allows you to specify only one ACNSO, not multiple, even if you might fit into multiple categories, and many people do fit into multiple categories. So just confirming that that's what it means, the wording in any final document should be made really clear. The wording, however, you have implies that I could endorse someone who didn't seek my nomination without asking them if they want to be endorsed by me. We have had situations where someone, we were interested in someone, and they said, no, I don't want to work under your auspices. So I think their approval has to be a key requirement if someone's going to be nominated by a group they didn't ask to be nominated. To endorse by a group they didn't ask to be endorsed by. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Donna, I see your hand up. Can I just quickly answer Alan, unless obviously yours is related to this?
Yeah, of course, Lars. Go ahead.
Thank you, Donna. Alan, so the first point is well taken. Obviously, this is a may. The SONACs are free to nominate any or none of the applicants. So we'll make that clear in the final document. That's very helpful. In terms of communication, so I agree with you, obviously, from our end, you know, everybody has to be happy that they are, you know, kind of nominated by the organization that they would like to be nominated by or are confident or happy to be nominated by. The problem we kind of have here, this is not a pushback, it's just an explanation, that when we're drafting this document, we're also careful not wanting to be overly prescriptive. It's a general observation more than on this specific point, maybe. We'll make that clear that there should be communication between a candidate and the SOAC, especially if they indicate an SOAC would like to nominate somebody who has not indicated that they would like to be nominated by them. So that's a good point. And in general, we like to keep this as kind of loosely formulated as possible so that the SOAC required to an extent, obviously, to do this nomination process. Donna, please go ahead.
Thanks, Lars. Donna Austin. So one of the challenges for the GNSO is related to, the fact that people identify as a candidate from the GNSO, but the GNSO Council has a selection standing committee that it uses for selecting people to the review teams. And one of the challenges we've had is that somebody identifies with the GNSO, but our SSC folks don't actually have any visibility into that person, or, it seems that maybe that person isn't part of the GNSO. So that creates one challenge. I'm not sure how we get around that, but perhaps the ability to validate initially that the person is actually part of the SOAC that they claim to be from. But the other question or suggestion is the nomination process itself is all based around tying yourself to an SO or AC. And to me, that seems to restrict the possibility of new blood. So, we might have people from the fellowship or people that have an interest in ICANN but haven't actually identified with an SO or AC, but have an interest in the subject that would like to be part of a review team. And I think by having this requirement that you have to identify with an SO or AC makes that a bit of a challenge for those people. So just to flag it as an issue that I see, this requirement that you have to fit into a box of an SO or AC actually might detract from getting some new blood and new people involved in some of ICANN processes. So I wonder if there's another way that we can think about how we do this. And if somebody doesn't actually fit into an SO or AC, is there another way for their candidacy to be considered for a review team or any other process? Thanks, Lars.
Thanks, Donna. I don't know if your hand is up again. I'm going to reply quickly to this. Donna, so I think 2 points. I think what we can do is that when we put out the call for volunteers, kind of make clear whether people would either be identified either with one or several SOACs, or they don't identify with any and would be happy to be selected by any SOAC. So that I don't think that's any problem. It's something that I think falls under the call for volunteers, which is not part of this presentation, but we'll obviously take that into account. Just very briefly on your point of the kind of wanting or even desire or usefulness of appointing somebody who is, a fellow or even just a subject matter expert, but who for one reason or another doesn't identify with or fall into or doesn't want to any of the 7 SNACs. The issue, we've thought about this too, obviously, the concern that we have, or concern is not the wrong word, but the limitation that there is are the bylaws, which state that the chairs, who make the final selection, obviously, of the up to 21 people, can only select people who have previously been nominated by SONAC. So if the GNSO wants, my cousin is an expert and who is, and the GNSO, but he's never been part of ICANN, and the GNSO would like to nominate him, then the only way would that happen was if the GNSO kind of looks at that application, the selection committee, and says, look, this person has all the skills necessary and desired. They seem to be independent, and we're happy to nominate them, and then the chairs can select that person. There is no way around that from our interpretation of the bylaws for the chairs to kind of pick somebody out who has not been previously nominated. So that's kind of the vicious circle of sorts. I'm conscious of going back and forth in patients. Alan, please go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of very quick points. I have no problem with someone saying they are currently unaffiliated, but the reality is that they may well be ignored in that case. I would, and there's a related issue that we always have a need to communicate with the candidate. In these post-GDPR days, it's not even clear that you can give us their email address. So I would strongly suggest that, that number one, they give permission for their email address to be used so that they can be contacted, or they don't give permission, and in which case we're not allowed to contact them. That may doom them to their fate, but so be it. But I really think communication prior to nomination is really important, even more so if they are currently saying they're unaffiliated. So I think that's something that must be considered going forward. It doesn't mean you publish the email addresses, but the chairs need to be able to contact these people. And I think at that point it's reasonable. The CCWG accountability, in its wisdom, and I say that with great sarcasm, eliminated the concept of unaffiliated experts, and we have to live with that at the moment. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. That's a good point. We'll definitely take that on board for the call for volunteers to kind of have a box there to allow communication with the chairs. Donna, please.
Yeah, thanks, Lars. And I don't want to hold you up too much on this point, but perhaps one way around this is when, ICANN.org does the original analysis of skills and diversity of candidates. If there is, half a dozen candidates that are not affiliated, then perhaps it's just a random appointment that either the GNSO or ALAP, CCNSO actually consider, one person each as part of their slate. Maybe that's one way around it. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe I would take that on board. All right, very good. We'll move on to the next, certainly no less controversial, difficult issue of the selection of the review team members. So you may recall this is done by the SOAC chairs. So first of all, the community feedback was that the SONAC preferences on nominated candidates should be binding on SOAC chairs, which kind of in a square bracket is requires a very liberal reading of the bylaws, but it is something that the community and their responses felt very strongly about. It's a practice that is taking place at the moment, and so we didn't feel confident shunning that in any way, but going with the community desires here. The second is the support for ICANN organization to provide SOAC chairs with a non-binding analysis of the set of nominee skills and diversity based on skills and requirements in the call for volunteers, which is essentially the same document we share with the SOACs, only that that allows ICANN.org to obviously provide kind of a global assessment of the hypothetical review team based on the nomination process. And the SOACs should not be allowed to reserve a review team seats for later selection to avoid the disruption of the review team's work. Just as a reminder, those three are all feedback from the community. And so based on that, what is proposed, and you see this goes over two slides, first of all, the non-binding analysis will be done and shared with the chairs, and also communicated with the board via the Organizational Effectiveness Committee, the OEC. And then as part of the oversight function, the board, again via the OEC, will inform the SOAC chairs of any concern it may have with regard to diversity or skill set of the nominees meeting the requirements detailed in the bylaws. Donna, I'm going to get to the question in a moment. Let's just finish this and I get back. The SOAC chairs are encouraged but not required to select the review team within 3 weeks after receiving the nominee list and ICANN organization's non-binding skill and diversity analysis. The chairs may confer with the respective SOACs to nominate different candidates if the pool of nominees is insufficiently diverse or skilled. The chairs also, if the chairs find that the pool of candidates, the overall pool, does not reflect a sufficiently diverse and skilled review team, that they, so the chairs, may agree to reopen the call for volunteers, also in with consultation of their full SONACs, obviously. The chairs cannot reserve review team seats for later selection, and if the review team determines that it, once it's seated, it does not have sufficient skills or diversity, they can address this with the SONACs in whatever form the review team itself deems appropriate. And I see that Alan has already answered Donna's question. There was a precedent for that, and so that was not supported in the public comments, and so we eliminated that as a possibility. Right. I'm going to move on to the next topic. Obviously, if you've got questions, please raise your hand, and you can also go back to any of these issues at the end of the presentation. The next issue is the setting of the scope, which had a very complicated, some may say, innovative system, how the scope were to be set prior to the start of review in the original document. That didn't receive a lot of support, to put it mildly, and so we restructured that. Before I go into this, just a couple of definitions. The scope of work specifies the topic the review team will address within the bounds of the bylaws, obviously. And then there's a couple of different terms here that are used by the review teams and will feature here in the coming slides. The terms of reference, which demonstrate kind of at a high level how the objectives of the review will be accomplished. And the work plan, which details more specifically or in more detail by what time which task will be performed and by whom. And so the community feedback on the scope setting was that there was very strong support for the review team being charged with setting its own scope without prior community consultation. And so a large majority of community sees no reason to have the scope set before the review team is assembled. And so based on that, what is being proposed is that the review team sets its own scope within a suggested 8-week period. Again, none of these time frames are mandated. That the scope of work is included in a dedicated section of the terms of reference and then further elaborated in the work plan. Once the review team adopts the scope of work and work plan, it will seek input or feedback from the SOAC leadership and the ICANN board, something that happens already at the moment. The review team is encouraged, again, not required, to take input from the community and the board into account and update the scope as they see fit, unless the board finds the scope violates the bylaws. And that brings me to the fourth point, which is that the board obviously has the responsibility to assure that the scope does not violate the bylaws. So if the board finds a potential violation, and points it out to the review team, then the review team would indeed be required to adapt the scope to make sure it's fully within the bounds of the bylaws. With that, I'm going to move swiftly to the next topic, which is the reporting requirements. Alan, you've got your hand up. I assume it's...
Yeah, just one quick comment. When you put up the notice, one of the bullets that said you will not... The review team will not consult with the community prior to setting its scope. My initial reaction was, why not? But on reflection, the review team is made up of representatives from the community, and those people can consult to whatever extent they want with their own community and bring that feedback back into the group. So I'm happy with the result. I just wanted to put that line of thinking out. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna Tuppel. And if I can agree, absolutely. I think what we put that in there is because previously they kind of were mandated to consult the community, and so here they are not. Obviously, they're always free to talk to whoever they want. Donna, please.
Thanks, Lars. Donna Austin. Just in relation to the reluctance not to mandate a time frame, I understand why that might be the case, but I am a little bit concerned that anything that is open-ended becomes problematic in terms of a review that ends up taking much longer than it should and not being as efficient as it should, and then the drain on resources kicks in as well. So I understand the reluctance to mandate a time frame, but I think that's perhaps not within the bounds of the different parts of what the review team has to do along the way, but I would think that providing something that does have a, you know, at the end of the day, this is something that should be completed within 12 months, and if not, then there should be a requirement that the review team comes back to the community and explains why. And, you know, this is clashed with my GNSO Council-based chair hat on and the PDPs that we have underway and have been underway for some considerable period of time. This is an issue that we're running into, is that, you know, these pieces of work become open-ended and it becomes very difficult to bring them back. So while I understand the reluctance to mandate time frames, there has to be some requirement, and I expect it's for the review team to explain to the community why it's not meeting the recommended time frame. Thanks, Lars.
Hey, Donna, I suspect that Alan will have an answer to that. Alan.
Well, I'm not going to sure I'm going to have an answer. I'm going to have an opinion. Number one, I believe, according to the bylaws, it's only ATRT that has a specific timeline. If I look at the example of the RDS review team that I've been chairing, there's a huge difference between saying you must complete in a year and it's going to be open-ended and go on forever. We are going to complete effectively about 15 months after we started real work. Our original convening date, however, probably is a month or two before that, just because of how these things work, and it took time to get to actually get organized and find a time to meet. In terms of the 8 weeks for the scope, that's probably too short, because it takes a face-to-face meeting is a very effective way of coming to closure on things like scope, and it takes MSSI at least 6 weeks to organize an off-site meeting, and you know, and then it has to be everyone can make that meeting in exactly 6 weeks. So it's likely to take 2 months after the review team convenes to schedule a face-to-face meeting, and it could well be longer than that, depending on the time of the year and availability of the review team members. So although I agree that we should have a suggested time frame, 8 weeks is probably a bit too short, and in terms of the overall length of the review team, yes, they should be constrained and do it in a reasonable amount of time, but I don't think 12 months is necessarily that reasonable time. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. So just to cap this, Donna, so, you know, we struggled with the same thing. You know, of course, we are aware of resources and straining release going on. Alan raises a very valid point. I don't think it's necessarily an MSSI issue of taking 6 weeks to organize a meeting. I think the different components come into that. But be that as it may, it is difficult to kind of restrict it, if you want, within 12 months and to be overly prescriptive timeframes. If you and the GNSO use the timeframes mandated, and then potentially with an exception to prolong those, if need be, would be appropriate, I can encourage you to submit that, obviously, to the public comment in December. But at the moment, from a staff perspective, we are not confident to do this based on the feedback that we received and the experience that we had with the reviews. And with that, I'm moving on to the reporting requirements of the review teams. This is an issue that didn't feature in the previous iteration of the draft operating standards. It's kind of something that came out of the best practices from the reviews that are ongoing at the moment. And so this is what is being proposed, is that the review team is encouraged, obviously, to update the community consistently and transparently using a variety of mechanisms. It is useful for the review team, obviously, to define in its terms of references, procedures by which it will ensure progress is being relayed to the community and the board as well in a timely and appropriate fashion. This is, again, something that happens already at the moment with the current reviews. The review team is encouraged to develop and adhere to an outreach plan based on any commitments made in the terms of references, and ICANN organization will provide templates for that. The leadership should provide these updates throughout the review if requested, and ICANN organization obviously may support those outreach efforts if the leadership team deems that appropriate. And as always the practice, ICANN organization will continue to develop fact sheets to support reporting no less frequently than every quarter. I think in some cases they're actually being published every 2 months, but at the very least every quarter. And the fact sheet shall detail at a minimum kind of relevant metrics to the review, including attendance records of members, progress of work, obviously, and also budget. That is the reporting requirement. The next issue is the monitoring of the review progress. Again, this is an issue that did not feature in the previous iteration. However, the community feedback on reviews conducted under the new bylaws kind of have reiterated the need to monitor the review progress in an appropriate way. So what is proposed here is the, first of all, some basic background to make sure that nobody to assure that the review team conducts its work autonomously within its mission, defined scope and budget in accordance obviously with the provisions of the bylaws and the operating standards once adopted. Also, obviously, review team members are empowered to formulate recommendations based on its evaluation of facts. The review team is accountable to the global community, the iGlobal ICON community, and performing its duties effectively, adhering to the terms of references and the operating standards. And obviously, they should use and utilize volunteer time and ICON resources appropriately. So then the monitoring of the process should be done by the SNRC and the ICON board via the appropriate committee, the OEC. And this should kind of include monitoring of timely and effective completion of milestones, effective use of volunteer time, members' participation and contribution levels, and that the scope of the review should avoid duplication of other community initiatives to help ensure that the review results in useful recommendations. And with that, we kind of come to the linked dispute resolution proposal. Again, something that didn't feature in the previous iteration, but due to lessons learned, it's something that we included in or will include in the upcoming full document. So what is proposed here is that conflicts or disputes between review team members, so interpersonal or intra-review team disputes, shall be addressed in line with conflict resolution escalation paths used in other community working groups, for example, the GNSO operating procedures. Obviously, the review team also may use any other guidelines or procedures, ideally, that would have precedent within the ICON company. Concerns about the scope of work, the methodology, community outreach, or anything along those lines, it should be communicated directly to the review team via the leadership if they come from the outside. And obviously, if they come from inside the review team, it just would go to the chairs or the co-chairs. And the review team and the party that raised the concerns, whether inside or outside of the review team, should attempt to resolve the concerns directly through discussions. Every effort should be made for an expedient and productive resolution, obviously without undue disruption of the review team's work. And then to get to the little bit more meaty part here, subject to all privacy concerns, obviously, conflict-related conversations should be in conformity with transparency and accountability requirements. And then suggested approaches to resolving conflict or issues if direct interaction of the concerned parties does not lead to a productive outcome. So we have kind of four steps here. The first, obviously, that the concerned parties may bring the issue to the SONC chair. The chairs, or a forum of their choice, shall discuss the issue and provide appropriate resolution. The chairs, if they cannot agree on a solution, they would suggest an alternative means to arrive at a timely resolution, for example, facilitation, public consultation, or some other means as determined by the chairs to overcome the impasse. And such alternative means may require the RP to pause its work, but such disruption should be used only as a means of last resort by the SOEC chairs. And then finally, if the board identifies an issue with a review that poses significant risk to meeting ICANN bylaw obligations or a significant misuse of financial resources, the board will initiate consultation with the SOEC, and the resolution may include all the issues that were raised in point three here, up and two, including also a pausing of the review activities in accordance or agreement with the SOEC chairs and the SOEC. And then finally, once the dispute is resolved, consideration will be given to determine whether the current dispute resolution process, as outlined here, should in fact be modified because it either didn't work particularly well or, you know, some improvements work well, but still some improvements. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Alan, who's got it handled.
Thank you. Up until the last set of bylaws, the ACSO chairs had no responsibilities other than to their own groups. The bylaws gave the SOAC chairs the responsibility to select review teams. When the board decided action was required to, with regard to the SSR2, they gave some responsibility to the chairs to take action. Here we're seeing additional chair responsibilities. I will simply point out that, and I'm only going to be an ACSO chair for another 3 weeks, so to some extent I don't care. But the ACSO chairs have no resources to draw upon as it's currently orchestrated. We have no process by which we can do things. And if we're looking at what is suggested here, we're talking about the ACSO chairs taking some action where one of the ACSO chairs essentially as part of their community, that is the entity that's complaining or raising the issue, which puts that person in a really awkward position. So I think we need to be really, really careful looking at giving responsible to the ACSO chairs without providing them with some level of resources or methodology on which to do things. This is a discussion among the current chairs of how do we do this next time someone asks us to do things. But if we're going to put into formal rules that we have a responsibility in some areas, I think we have to think about it really carefully. It's not necessarily a given that it can be answered. And I perhaps question why we don't use the ombudsman as one of the intermediate processes here before it goes to someone else. So this whole thing is just loaded with interesting problems or potential. And I note in your point 4, you don't say the board will consult with the chairs. Now you're saying we'll consult with the SOs and ACs. I think you really mean with the SO councils and the ACs. I'm not sure you want to consult with the whole GNSO or the whole CCNSO, which is all of their membership. But maybe that is what you mean. I'm not sure. So I think you've got to be really careful on how you identify these things and how you're going to carry them out later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Before I go to Donna, just a couple of reflections on that. So we are aware of the problem of the chairs not being really an established forum with an icon with clear powers or decision-making procedures. And as you point out, they were kind of plummeted into this position of being involved in the review selection by the new bylaws. And so that is why we added here or a forum of their choice. So if the chairs didn't feel comfortable that they would have the mandate or the power to resolve this, then they would obviously find a way or a different forum to do so.
Not clear we have the power or authority to find another forum either. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's a good point, Alan. We thought this through, and I'm not saying this is the perfect solution, but what I'm trying to say is that it is not easy to find a way where to start, right? Are you going to write a letter to all the different councils? Maybe that's the best way to do it. I don't know. But since the chairs have done the selection process, they're clearly in some sort of responsibility position. And for us to prescribe that the chairs will be circumvented and we go straight to the councils, I think your note on the councils rather than the whole of the SOs is well noted. Point 4 is also not a particularly obvious or clear discussion. A solution, and so I would encourage you to make a better proposal during the public comment or even during the session in Barcelona. None of us feel particularly strongly that this is the best way forward. It's just the best way we have come up with over the past few months. And the ombudsman is a very good point. Sebastian made that in the chat as well. We referenced, you see this on the previous slide, I'm just going to go back, the GNSO operating procedures. And actually there in the escalation process of conflict resolution, it involves the ombudsman. So it is part of here. And Donna made the point in the chat that we should kind of elaborate on what these steps in the GNSO entail. And then obviously that would include the ombudsman. And we will most certainly do that. I think that's a very good point. Thank you. And I'm just going to read quickly through the chat unless there are any other questions. Donna, sorry, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, Lars, thank you. Donna Austin. I just wasn't sure whether – can you just go back to the previous slide? So is what comes in under what is proposed and all the dot points, is that kind of an escalation path? It's not clear to me whether that's the case or not, or whether we're dealing with, distinct possible areas of conflict that could come up within the review team itself, or whether this is a part of an escalation path. Because I think if all the dot points are kind of leading to if you start at this point, if you can't move forward, then you go to the next step and then the next step. It's not clear to me whether this is an escalation path or not. And to the point that Alan made about, SOAC leadership taking, having to take responsibility for some of these, if things start to go off the rails. In my point, that's one of the things about this new environment that we work in, is that I think the SOAC leaders do have more responsibility. Some of that we don't know what it is yet, because until we hit a certain situation, we don't know what to invoke. And I think what happened with the SSR2 clause was that the community was very strong that it wasn't for the board to make that decision. And then that left a gap about, well, whose decision is it? So it seemed to me that the logical place to go back to was the SOAC leaders. But then that put them in a very difficult position because they have no precedent for how to do this. So I guess one of the challenges that we have in this new environment is that we do need to make up processes as we go along when we come across something new. So, and I think this is one of the challenges that we have here in trying to identify what the dispute resolution process might look like. And I understand Alan's concern, but, my question is, well, where else can you go? I think Lars is right. I don't think it's a case of bringing it back to the respective councils. So I understand the concern, but I really had that question, well, where else do you go? If we don't think the board is the is the right place to take the concern, then there has to be somewhere else in the community that we can go.
Thank you, Donna. Alan, please.
Thank you. To be clear, I was not suggesting that the SOAC chairs are not the right place to go. I think they're a great place to go, but I don't think we can just toss things at them randomly. I think we need some discussion, probably among the current and probably some past ACSO chairs who have a fair amount of experience in this, to try to come up with some better methodology than just tossing it to them out of the blue and saying make up some rules. So I'm not supporting using the ACSO chairs effectively. I think they are a great resource, but I think we need to think about how we do that. That was the main point I was making. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Larissa.
Thank you, Lars. Larissa Gernick. Alan, I was wondering if I could follow up with you and ask for some of your thoughts and guidance on how we might facilitate a conversation like that, like what you suggested. You certainly have yourself many different hats that you have worn and a tremendous base of experience. So I think through this conversation and also with Donna's input, the challenges and the sort of the difficulty of this is clear, and we would very much welcome some thoughts and ideas for how to make this practical and useful and not overly complicated, because that's certainly the messages that we heard on the first draft and the suggestions from the community. Don't overcomplicate things. Keep things practical and useful and not overly burdensome from a process perspective. But yeah, there is important accountabilities and responsibilities here that, you know, we're grappling with. So any thoughts on what we might do to try and resolve some of these important points that you've raised?
If I may answer.
Of course.
Despite the difficulty of actually trying to find a time where you can get the chairs together to talk to them, which is one of the more difficult scheduling issues we've had recently, I don't think you'll find a group that's more amenable to talking about these things and looking for solutions. And no, we do not want a 400-page rule book. At least I certainly don't, and I hope my successors don't. But there may be support resources we need. We may want to consider, we may want to formalize, for instance, that if a chair is given a responsibility, is it the chair in their capacity as chair of the ACRSO or in their capacity of a wise person in the community who, you know, you're willing to give some authority to? That's been one of the issues, that it wasn't clear when the chairs were given SSR2. Was it the chairs, or was it the chairs along with their groups? You know, how much were they acting independently? How much were they supposed to be consulting? So there was no clarity on these kind of things, and different ACs, SOs handled it differently. So maybe differently is fine. Maybe it is something we should handle differently. But I think we need to talk about it not when there's a crisis, but beforehand, and try to figure out what is it we need. What guidance do we have? I mean, one of the questions that was raised in our group privately is liability. If the chairs make a decision on behalf of ICANN, what happens if someone objects and says, you've now slandered me and I'm going to sue? Are we indemnified? According to the current bylaws, the board is indemnified. We aren't. We have no indemnification at all. And yet that becomes really important when you're going to make a decision which is going to become public and may well involve a person. So lots of things to think about.
Thanks, Alan. Just as a final thought from our perspective when kind of thinking this through, the issue you raised of, you know, representation is something that concerns us as well, right? I mean, I used to support the GNSO. Part of the policy team, and I know that the chairs are not necessarily in any way authorized or feel to have the power to represent the whole of the GNSO. They are the chair of the GNSO Council. And so we would be very reluctant to mandate in these operating standards any concrete power to the seven chairs of the seven OCACs. That's why, again, we kind of have this loose aura forum of their choice into this. But yes, as Larissa said, and you as well, lots to think about, and we would really invite you to do think about this. You know, during the public comment period, this is really something that we struggle with to a degree, to kind of wanting to provide some guidelines, not wanting to create, as you say, Alan, a 500-page document. So we're very much looking forward to your thoughts on the plus side,
I'll have a lot more time available in 3 weeks.
I'm glad to hear it. Sebastian, before I go to you, just very quickly, I'm so sorry. Jim, I saw your comment on the financial issues here for the board. Jim had a concern that this kind of too broadly phrased and would kind of give the board a possibility to kind of intervene almost at will. Certainly not what we had in mind. I've taken that on board, and we will fiddle with the wording to make sure that there are some constraints on there and it couldn't be interpreted that broadly. Thanks. And Sebastian.
Thank you, Lars. Yeah, I want to add to the comment made already about the chairs doing this. We have to be very careful that there are volunteers, and I am not sure that they can do everything. I know that some chairs do a lot, maybe too much. But if we add to the basket of the chair all those things, maybe we will be having a good chair to do that, but a bad chair to chair the meetings or to participate in a working group or to, because I'm not sure that all those different things that the chair is supposed to do today are the same skill, and they have obligatory all the skills at once. Therefore, I would like that you think about maybe, and it's easy to say that now. It could be somebody who was chair, because it will be less work, but it will be not adding to the current work of the chair. Or it could be some other people delegated by an SO or an AC to do this specific job. I am not sure that the chair must be the one where when we have something new, we come to and we say, hey, guy, or hey, lady, you need to do that in addition to all the things you already do. Really need to be very careful. Or we will end up, and it could be also a good idea, when we discuss about indemnification or payment of the board member, the discussion starts but stops, unfortunately, very soon about why not the chair of the SOAC could be also indemnified. That means that they will have more time or not be all retired to do the job. Retired is the joke. But that's we need to be very careful on what we want them to do at the end of the day. What is more important? Thank you.
Thanks, Sebastian. That's also a very good point. I'm going to press on. We've only got 5 minutes left, and I think we can breathe through the final two or three slides. Hopefully, this is more straightforward. Roles and responsibility of the various kind of parties that are concerned or involved in the review process. Again, something that wasn't in the previous document, but we think it's maybe a helpful guideline to be part of the operating standards. The review team, participate in the meetings, engage in the mailing list. Review team members, I should really say here, engages with relative stakeholders within the IKN community. It undertakes desk research, which with the scope of work, and obviously participates in drafting. The leadership of the review team would make sure that the RT drives towards the key milestones, always in line with the scope, obviously, determines and identifies the level of consensus when that time comes, manages the budget, either themselves, obviously with designated member review team members, and works with the ICANN organization to maintain accountability and transparency. The SONACs, they nominate seven candidates for the review team from the bylaws. They review the adopted scope and share any concerns with the review team, something we mentioned previously on this webinar, and obviously also monitor the progress and provide input to the review team if and when appropriate. The chairs, they select a group of up to 21 members in line with the bylaws, and they provide advice towards conflict resolution. Obviously, this is square bracket subject to the outcome of the conversation that we just had. But there we are at the moment. The board performs the requirements as outlined in the bylaws, oversees the conduct of the review or monitors the progress via the OEC, participates in the review through its board-appointed review team member, who represents board positions if and when appropriate. And then the ICANN organization provides project management and admin support, provides guidance to the review team on best practices and useful resources if asked to do so, and obviously also project manages the implementation of the board-approved recommendation if and when those have been approved by the board indeed. And with that, I'm just going to plow through the last two slides. We have 3 minutes left. The next steps, I kind of alluded to that already. There's a meeting and session, the ICANN meeting in Barcelona on Wednesday, the 24th, 3:30 to 4:45. We know that this probably overlapped with some other sessions. The operating standard was not one of the high interest topics identified by the community. So if that's not the case, we kind of, you know, as you know, you end up with the time you're essentially being given by the Tanzania, who always does their best to have minimal overlap, but it cannot be avoided. In addition to that, if any of the SRNACs would like to have a presentation on this to kind of provide more in-depth detail, feel free to reach out to MSSI. We know it's late in the game and most of your agenda is already set, but if you can squeeze us in for 5 or 10 minutes, we are certainly happy to attend your session at any time that is convenient to you. And then finally, the full document will be published in December, taking into account feedback from this webinar, today's webinar later on, and any feedback we received during Barcelona. And if you have any other feedback that you can't provide here, would like to write in writing, you're always welcome to do so via the MSSI Secretariat email address, or just email any member of the MSSI team, and we will deal with that accordingly and pass it on to our colleagues. And finally, the board will hopefully adopt the operating standard, the post-public comment, depending on how long that will be open for in March or April. Yeah. With that, we have 1 minute to go, and Alan's got his hands up. Alan, please.
Yeah, just a quick word. Keep it as light as you can. We have not had many specific reviews or AOC reviews. We're still under 10, I think. I've been personally involved with two. I have really strong insights into another two of them, and they're all different. So it's really difficult to learn lessons and set firm rules for all ones that will follow based on occurrences that may only have happened in one review or two reviews. They are all different, and how they have unfolded is different. And moreover, the level of support they have gotten from the ICANN organization has radically changed in this last set of reviews from the ones that were done a few years ago. So let's keep things flexible. Agile is a term I used. The RDS review, according to the current practices, set a really rigid, tight timeline, but we've changed it. Yes, it was in the terms of reference, tough. When we found that it wasn't working, we changed it. And that ability to be agile is really important in going forward. This is still a learning game. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. That's certainly something I think we on the drafting team certainly agree with. I see that Donna is just writing one final comment into the chat, but unless there are any other questions, I think we can end the webinar almost on time. Donna agrees with Alan's point. And Larissa, I'm going to hand over to you for the last word. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much, Lars. I just wanted to take this opportunity, first of all, to thank you all for really a great discussion and for participating in this, and also to remind you that there is a public comment period that closes tomorrow on a related topic, which is next steps on reviews. And we have not had any public comments submitted as of yet, so just wanted to flag that as a reminder. We would very much welcome input on that. It's a brief proposal, we would really appreciate some commentary on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Larissa. Donna.
Yeah, Lars, sorry, and sorry for holding everybody up. One quick question. Is it the intention that these operating procedures will guide the work of the ATRT3?
Yeah, that's a good question. We discussed this, Donna. I think what our intention would be, subject to approval, obviously, by the community, is to provide this document, especially when it's out for public comment, to the ATRT3 and ask them to use it as if it was in place as it's written. And then if they see, look, this is not working, we don't like this, this seems impractical, to provide ICANN org with that feedback, and so we can then take them into consideration when we kind of update the operating standard after the public comment. So we would like to see this as a guiding and in no way a binding document on the
Okay, so they could use it as a test run effectively, which seems to make good sense.
Quite right.
Yep. Thanks, Lars.
Thank you. All right, and with that, thank you, everybody. The webinar will obviously be posted. The recording will obviously be posted. Also, again, on the website, I'm just going to put that same little spiel into the chat. And I hope I'll see most of you in Barcelona. Have a good day, good evening, and good morning, wherever you are. And Yvette, please stop the recording. Thank you, everyone.